This is Scripture Read Badly,
a podcast where two grown-up pastors' kids discuss the stories of the Bible in chronological order,
attempting to avoid heresy and generally having a good time.
I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Ryan.
Sit back and rejoice.
Today's verse comes from Judges chapter 8, verse 28. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more. This is a classic example of sore losers in the Bible. Like when Midian got beaten, suddenly they hung their heads and they're just like, oh, I don't want to try again. Because that's what always happens in sporting games with people that are good, but when they get beaten, they hang their heads and that leads to an even poorer performance. So this is Sore Losers in the Bible, and Scripture Read Badly. My name is Ryan.
And I'm Jeremy, and I have definitely been known to be a sore loser sometimes, although sometimes I'm the complete opposite. I'm a non-sore loser. I don't know what the opposite is.
A gracious loser?
A gracious loser. A celebratory loser. Like, good job, champs. Yeah. I'll see you on the field.
Yeah.
But I love a sore. I love a good sore loser. The best example of recent times that you may remember is the almost decade-long dominance of the Queensland rugby league team over the New South Wales rugby league team. Yep. And we were living in New South Wales, but I was going for Queensland because they're better team. And it was so fun watching the sore losers. She was like, yeah, you must have paid the umpires more money this time. Sure did. Sure.
That's classic. Oh, man. When people take things too seriously, it's so funny.
It is so funny.
I mean, if you're removed from the situation. If not, it can get a little bit dicey.
Yep.
But for the most part, if you are watching the Super Bowl and you don't have a dog in the fight, or to use a dated analogy, or you don't really support either of the teams, then to watch the people that get so upset when their team loses or a thing goes against you or whatever, it's pretty funny. You're that person, it's not, obviously.
No, it's terrible. But it's like life-changingly bad.
That's right. Well, here we have Midian doing that in this intro verse, but before we get there, we left the last episode on a bit of a cliffhanger, and that was halfway through chapter 7. Gideon was told what to do by a god, and he told his men how to go about things. He snuck down to the camp and overheard some people saying, I had a dream that Gideon and his army came and absolutely destroyed us. We're really afraid. And then he's like, that's the sign. Good to go. He gave everybody jars and candles or fires and trumpets and told them to surround the camp. And that was the cliffhanger that we left last week's episode on, or last time's episode. So, Jeremy, what do you think is going to happen before we really get stuck into the text?
Well, on numbers, you think they're only 300. They're not really battling warriors versus this camp of actual warriors with probably better weapons and better strategy. Mm-hmm. And so one would think, why wouldn't you sneak in and like slowly murder them in their sleep? Why would you get trumpets and pots and fire? This is a terrible strategy. And because Gideon is the worst of the worst, you would also think he's a big loser and there's no way that he will win. But then you think, in God's history, he usually uses losers and they usually don't lose. They're winners because of God.
Yeah. And before we get any further, what you said there just sparked an idea in me. And that is that Gideon, while he came from the least significant tribe in Israel, the least significant clan in Israel, in his opinion, God obviously uses him to lead an army and to bring about a victory and so forth. And we'll see in these next couple of chapters what becomes of Gideon And it seems as though he goes on to be a great leader in Israel. And so, Jeremy, what I want to ask you is, have you ever encountered the type of, I wouldn't say it's a philosophy, but maybe the things playing out in such a way that somebody who seems to not be a very good leader has to step up and take charge, and then that propels them into a lifetime of leadership, and they kind of discover an ability they never knew they had?
Yeah, heaps of times. In, okay. In some ways that, like, my original story was that I grew up in leadership and didn't want it, and so walked away from it. But then when I was chucked back mm-hmm. into leadership because no one else was around, I was like, oh, I'm actually okay at this and I like it, so I'll just do it whenever I need to. But then you find yeah. other people who didn't grow up in leadership officially. Like, in the organization we both have been in, there's many leaders who grew up on a farm. And on a farm, you're not necessarily mm-hmm. leading people, but you're definitely put in positions of leadership that you have to make decisions that affect a lot of things. And you find these ex-farmers come into the organization and are asked to lead people, and it's almost a natural swap because they just have to make decisions. And they make mistakes on the way, but that's how leadership works most of the time.
Right.
So these aren't necessarily mm-hmm. losers. They're just people who weren't technically led to lead, which is interesting.
And they may have had positions of leadership in certain aspects of their previous lives.
Yeah.
For example, with a farmer, and even taking the King David from the Bible, he looked after sheep, and when God called him to look after people and to lead people, he was able to use principles that he'd learned as a shepherd in being the king and leading armies and things. And it was adapting principles that you learn early on in life to propel you into great things later. So that's what I feel may have been happening with Gideon here. He was obviously a farmer, not necessarily looking after sheep, because what the glimpse into his previous life that we see at the beginning of chapter 6, I think, is that he was trampling grain. He was threshing grain in the wine press to hide it from the Midianites.
Yep.
So he was a farmer, somebody that understood responsibility and waiting in order to bring about a harvest. So maybe that's kind of what God was counting on for this particular judge, waiting until the harvest was ripe, until this precise moment when God was going to bring about a victory, and then having somebody that was willing to go in and reap the harvest, so to speak.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, so what happens towards this tail end of chapter 7?
Exactly the opposite of what I thought. And so he comes over the top of the mountain, and or the outskirts of the camp. Maybe there's no mountain. I think I watched an animation that he came over a mountain, and it was in the middle of the watch, which you assume is the middle of the night or when everyone's asleep.
They were in a valley, okay. So he was coming down from a mountain, and he split up. He split the 300 into three different groups, so he's kind of flanking them from all sides.
And they blew the trumpets, which freaks people out in the middle of the night when they're sleeping. And they broke the mm-hmm. jars, which would be a freaky sound surrounding them. And they held in their left hands the torches, and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." So here's 300 people surrounding you, smashing things, yelling, blowing trumpets and having fire in the middle of the night where you didn't think anyone was around. So technically, the watch, in quotation marks, isn't really doing its job if they came up and surprised. And that's 300 trumpets. So you imagine one trumpet times by 300, that's a ridiculous noise.
Yep.
And the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. So it wasn't that the 300 ran down and stabbed a whole bunch of people. because the freak out of the army almost did it themselves, right?
Exactly. And the fact that they had a torch in one hand and a trumpet in the other meant they didn't have the swords in either of their hands. So they were taking a non-violent approach to this victory.
Yep. And the army fled as far as a lot of different places.
Right, yep. And remember, we do have that the map on our shared Google Doc here. So I don't know if any of the towns listed here in the passage are actually going to be on the map, but let's assume that they headed east, away from Ephraim, back towards Ammon or something like that.
Yep. And then they called more people. So the Israelites that were called afterwards to pursue them, I wonder if they had weapons also. And then it did become a fight, or if they were just chasing them with trumpets.
All right. Well, I wonder if these were the same guys that went home because they used their hands to drink at the river. Because it did say in a previous verse that because they whittled it right down to 300, he sent everybody home. And initially when he was calling forth an army, he was going through all the tribes that are listed here at the end of chapter 7. So he's essentially sent them home, and even though they wanted to fight, they wanted to defend their nation, their tribes, their families, they still got to do that. It just wasn't in the timing that they expected in the first place.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool.
Hmm.
Which is pretty cool, but still an interesting ploy of God's that he uses less people with no swords to defeat a huge army to remind the people that he fights for them, not themselves. And then the language of capture is used in the end of the chapter, so you wonder if they did capture towns that were taken originally from that army, and they take it back and they resettle, or if it's just them pushing them out of the city limits, in quotation marks. I just had a stroke.
Yeah.
In quotation marks.
So it does say that they captured the land as far as the Jordan, and we do know that there are a few tribes on the east of the Jordan. But it seems as though they pushed the Midianites all the way back out of the land that they lived in. So they would keep on coming in and stealing all the crops and then just hanging around doing whatever they wanted and impressing Israel. But now Israel has kicked them out of their country.
Yep.
And said, go back to your homeland. And they kind of chased them out with swords, obviously killing a lot of people along the way. Capturing a couple of princes, killing one by a rock and one by a wine press, which I think might be maybe a touch of irony that one of them was killed at a wine press, given that Gideon was trying to hide in a wine press earlier, and so here we're making a big deal of the fact that this wine press was a location that that one of the princes was killed at.
Was murdered in the wine press. That's probably an Agatha Christie novel right there. Murder in a wine press.
If we have any mystery writers out there that listen to this, then please go ahead and write that story, Murder at the Wine Press.
And that's feature Poirot, but he's a dog detective, and he can only bark Morse code.
So he's like Inspector Rex, but with rhythm.
Yep, I know who Inspector Rex is. Is he Poirot but a dog?
Yeah. Alright, so then we have chapter 8. And now this is the continued conquest of Gideon. So he not only defeats the army that was gathered in the valley and chases them all out and calls all of Israel to come and subdue their ex-oppressors. But then the men of Ephraim, we remember that he is an Ephraimite himself, I think. I think he was.
I think that too.
Yeah. yes. Yes, I think he was. So, the men of Ephraim say to him, "What have you done to us not to call on us when you went to fight against Midian?" So, really interesting thing seems to have happened where he sent messengers to a lot of different tribes saying, "Come and help, subdue these people, kill them." But he did not send messengers to those that were close by in Ephraim. And I think they have the guts to accuse him of not including them because perhaps he was a lesser member of their own tribe.
Yep.
Okay, so they accuse him and he says to them, "What have I done in comparison with you? Isn't gleaning the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer?" So he's saying, look, my clan isn't that significant, so even the best that my clan has isn't as good as the worst of yours, or the worst of the rest of the tribe, so
yep.
Why are you picking on me like this?
Yep.
I'm nobody to you. And then he says, "God has given into your hands the princes of Midian." So he's basically saying, God brought about this victory, and you were there.
Yep.
The men of Ephraim, you at least had the potential to be there. And when I sent out all these messengers, you surely would have heard of it, but you didn't come to help. So God has given these princes to you. You've killed them. So what do you really have to hold against me?
True.
Which is, it's a little bit confusing that they seem to have participated in the fight, yet they are maybe claiming that they weren't as involved as they could have been and blaming that on Gideon?
Yeah.
All right, so which is odd. Then what happens?
I was about to call him Gideon. Yep, that's probably his name in some cultures. And then Gideon came to the Jordan with his 300, who were actually very exhausted, as you can tell from them attacking in quotation marks and then running after the people. Yep. And he asks the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zebah and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian," mm-hmm. who you assume everyone knows who they are and how they've been oppressing people and attacking people. So you would think the people are like, "Whoa, we can help you attack them? We'll give you bread. That's easy."
Yeah. And the town of Succoth is just over the Jordan River into the tribe of Gad. So they've kind of pursued them northeast, and they have crossed over the Jordan River by this point.
Okay.
So they are actively pursuing them. They haven't kind of trapped them. So these are the ones that got away. Yep. And so then they're kind of going after pursuing them, obviously.
And you wonder too if these people, the men of Succoth, if they saw or heard the army passing past, and instead of saying, "Yeah, we'll give you bread and help you on your way," they're like, "Well, have you finished it yet? Like, have you already killed the people? Do you have their hands? The hands of Zebah and Zalmunna?" And Gideon responds as if, "Are you serious? I just wanted bread and I'm just trying to help you." Does this weirdly violent promise or curse and says, "Well, when the Lord has given me those two people, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." He's like, "Oh, that's a little over the top, but okay."
Wow. And that, then he goes to is more graphic than the she bears that Elisha
much
calls upon
more
the,
graphic.
The heckling youths.
The heckling youths. But then he goes to another town because he still needs bread. He still needs his men to be satiated with food and water.
So absolutely, they go to, they're starving.
Yeah, and they're, you can't fight a battle when you're not 100%. Well, you can, but it's terrible. And he says to the men of Peniel, which is the new town he goes to, Peniel answered.
The same thing.
Yeah, they said the same thing. So he says, when I come again in peace, I will break down the tower.
Yeah.
And you're just like, come on, you guys. And I wonder if it was because they had heard that he was a loser and they were like, you're not a real army captain. You're just a big old loser. Or if they were fearful, or if they just didn't believe anything that was happening. Like, why would they respond like that?
Yeah, maybe because Midian and the whatever surrounding nations had kind of banded together with them would come in and raid these tribes throughout the harvest. And so they basically have no food for themselves. And so I think maybe what they're saying is, how, if we give food to you, then we are essentially giving to you just like we give to them.
Oh, okay.
So if we give to you and you haven't killed them, then they're just going to come back and we'll have half as much food as we had before. So I think they're saying, we want reassurance that we're not going to get raided again, and then we'll give you food.
Okay.
But until that happens, we don't want to give what little food we do have now over to somebody else, even if it was to help them bring about the outcome that we want. So it's kind of backfiring on them. They're not being generous.
Yep.
And that ultimately might lead to some flesh flailing later.
Oh, you got a flesh flail. That's the best way to punish people. But that's a cool perspective flesh on what was happening. And then they don't come off as the worst people. Although then Gideon is making a comment on their faith or their trust in God to protect them and save them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he seems to give up the trying to get bread plan and just chases the army, which is still 15,000 men, which is still a lot bigger than 300.
But we do find out that there were 120,000 men. Sorry, 135,000 men in the valley that they either killed or chased out of there. And they had killed 120,000. Either in the valley they killed themselves or as they pursued them. So this is already massive loss for Midian. The military is now 10% of the size that it was at the beginning.
Yep.
So all that's left, they're kind of holding up in these cities.
So crazy.
In Karkor.
And then there's this comment in verse 12. No, 13. No, 12.
Yep.
And the army... Oh, so Gideon comes and attacks them again and they flee. And he captures them, the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and threw them all into a panic again. Hang on, where's the thing I was looking for? There's a comment that says they felt safe. Yeah, felt secure. So this is 11. Gideon went up by the way of the tent dwellers and attacked, for the army felt secure. Like, they got to a place where they're like, oh, this crazy maniac isn't here anymore. We can just have a rest. And that's exactly when Gideon comes again, captures the two kings, and throws them into panic again. And so it seems like they're not necessarily attacking them full on all the time, but they have these different strategies of waiting and then capturing and then blah, blah, blah.
And I'm not sure if this is entirely accurate, but there's a possibility that hardcore Karkor, the place that they fled to and felt safe was actually in the land of Ammon or something like that. So it wasn't even in Israel anymore, which is probably why they felt safe. They felt like Israel wouldn't pursue them into a neighboring nation who could potentially retaliate themselves. So maybe that's the reason for their security.
Interesting. And that makes sense, but also a great strategy of Gideon / Jesus's to attack them right then and there. Then Gideon returns from that battle and seems to come towards Succoth, because he captures a young man of Succoth and questions him and writes down all the officials and elders of Succoth, which was 77 men. And he came and said, "Behold, I have captured the people I said I would, about who you taunted me," saying, "Do you have the hands?" And he took the elders of the city, and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And he broke down the tower of Peniel and killed the men of the city. So he returns from attacking an enemy and then starts attacking locals to teach them a lesson, which...
Okay, seems a little odd. before we accuse him of being a bit of a bad bloke, I want to ask you if it was a situation where the deliverance of Israel, the entire nation, was at stake. Do you think this is beyond God's instruction for him to call a curse upon the elders of particular towns? Because I don't. I think we've seen worse. I think we've seen God inflict worse, either through Moses or through Joshua or even through plagues in the past up to this point. We've seen worse than this as a display of keeping promises and looking out for your Israelite brothers and sisters.
Yeah, and it could be possible that this is punishment for other sin as well.
Right.
Like, maybe it's not just that they refused to give them bread, because the way you explained it, it was... So, I suppose it was security and not trusting God. So, again, it was each man taking after themselves, which is what the judges were all about. And this is what Gideon is, a judge. And so maybe it was just a part of his judgment. And maybe this was a part of all the other judges, too, that they would violently judge people who were sinning, as well as the oppressor. Because then when we read the last few chapters, when Israel had just gotten terrible to each other, maybe that's just a comment on how they were all the time. And because these are the leaders and the elders of these places, it's not like he's going and slaughtering the women and the children. He's and it's not that he just slaughters them. He puts briars and thorns on them, so maybe they stay alive just in a lot of pain.
Yeah. I'm sure all of us have lived through a flesh flaying or two.
Oh, yeah. That's a normal Friday for me, right?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so that's one approach to it. The other is maybe this was Gideon's own decision. Maybe in the heat of the moment he was angry. Because it does say that... No, it doesn't say that Gideon was angry. It says that the men of Ephraim were angry at him. So I wonder if this anger and incredulity at the fact that these other tribesmen weren't helping led him to make a promise that he was bound to keep because he was acting on behalf of God as the judge. And so even if this wasn't God's instruction to make this display of these elders, maybe he had to keep the promise. And maybe this was a sin then? Maybe he acted out of anger?
Yeah.
What do you think is more likely? Do you think it's more likely that it was his own decision or that God instructed him to say that and make that display of them?
I don't know, because what you say just then is also similar to that other guy who said, "Whatever comes out of my house first, I will sacrifice to the Lord," and it ends up being his daughter.
Right.
And that's not really a anger... what is it called, promise, but it's more like a flippant promise without thinking.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if Gideon was so tired and so hungry on his own behalf, but also on behalf of the 300 men, like, "I've got to feed these guys or they're going to desert me," that he made a flippant promise of like, "Oh, I hate you, I'm going to flay you." And then he moves to the next place, and maybe Peniel was known for their tower, so he was like, "Oh, I'm just going to destroy your tower."
Yeah.
So it could be either... Although God's maybe character points...
Maybe he was hangry. Maybe that was it.
Oh, exactly. Of course he's hangry.
He's
probably rubbing his stomach, thinking of what good food he could eat.
So, have you ever... I don't think I ever have, but have you ever heard the word hanger in reference to the term hangry?
No.
Because I haven't, and I should have.
I've heard, "Hey, I'm hangry." But I haven't heard of, like, Oh, the noun I had so much hanger that I stabbed a guy.
Yeah. All right, well, Gideon was maybe acting out of hanger here. Maybe that was it.
True. A lot of hanger.
All right.
And it's probably in the text, but the Hebrew didn't have a good translation for that into English until right now.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry, okay, Bible translators, it's hanger.
Yeah. Don't let the sun go down in your hanger. All right, so then Gideon says to Zebah and Zalmunna, "Where are the men whom you killed at Tabor?" And so he's telling them to essentially, I think he's trying them for their crimes. And they said, "As you are, so are we. Every one of them resembled the son of a king." So they're saying, "We're princes and we are high ranking, and that's basically how we see you. You are equal with us." And this may come back later in Gideon's life, perhaps. The fact that he is seen as royalty. Maybe.
Interesting.
But Gideon says, "They're my brothers, they're the sons of my mother. And as the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you." And so he tells his firstborn, Jetha. How old do you think his firstborn was? Because I think we decided that Gideon was his early 20s, so maybe we have to adjust that.
Yeah, but if he started when he was 16, so now he could be 26, and his firstborn could be 10.
Alright. Okay, it does say the young man.
Okay. And then he's like, "Hey, 10-year-old, go kill these people."
Yeah, wow, that's intense. I don't know why he would do that. But he does tell his firstborn, Jetha, or Jeth. I don't know. Can't think of a good nickname for him. Jay. But he tells his firstborn, little Jay, to get up, kill him, and he says, I'm not going to. He doesn't draw his sword. He's afraid because he is still a young man. All right, so he might be 10 years old. That's fair. So then...
And then they taunt him again. They're like, "Rise yourself and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength." As in, like, don't get your little boy son to do it. You do it yourself. Be a man.
Yeah, wow.
And so Gideon does.
Yeah, he absolutely does. He does not hesitate at all. So, okay, maybe... Now, this is just a theory. Maybe because they appealed to his pride by saying... "You are like one of us. You're like a prince. You hold yourself with great esteem, and you seem very regal in your leadership style." Then maybe that led him to be arrogant and assume that his son would kill them. And so instead of taking responsibility like he was supposed to as the judge, he was trying to pass it off and exercise authority he didn't necessarily have.
True.
Or shouldn't have?
Shouldn't have is probably right.
Okay. Alright, so they take all of the...
Although,
the
now
things.
He's like an army commander, so he does have authority to an extent, but not to the point of kingship. But whatever. He could be a king.
Well, I feel like we may see a bit of a decline in Gideon's life over the rest of this chapter, and as a result, we may even have a bit of an insight into how he viewed himself.
Ooh.
So, the men of Israel say to him, "Rule over us, you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian." Gideon says, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." So he has the right response. He's saying, "I won't be your king. God will be your king. But I'll be the liaison. I'll go between." And then he says, "Let me make a request of you. every one of you giving the earnings of your spoil. So he's doing what was customary sometimes in battles, to pile all the spoils together.
Yep.
And to either melt them down if it was gold, or to distribute them however it was supposed to be distributed, with a certain amount going to the ruler and a certain amount going to the people and so forth. But they give him all of the golden earrings, and the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian. So there's a whole bunch of spoils, and they're really valuable. And the 1,700 shekels, let me see if I have a footnote here, was an unknown amount. I don't have an exact amount in my Bible. Sorry for the misleading.
I'm trying to find ephod in the in my Bible dictionary, but it doesn't seem to be here.
Hmm.
Ephron,
all right, let me see.
Ephraim.
So I'm going to... This is the best part of the show, where we're both looking things up. 1,700 shekels weight.
So the ephod shekel be in here?
I think the ephod was worn by the priest. It was the it was like an over the head vest thing.
Okay. Ooh, a vest.
Like a sweater vest. Summer on your arms and winter on your torso.
A sweater vest. Like
alright, let me see. 1,700 shekels converted is 19 kilograms of...
Wow, that's a whole bunch of gold.
Yeah, 19 kilograms of gold. So, pretty heavy. Oh, actually, yeah, pretty heavy considering it was all earrings.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't imagine... there would be some people that had heavy earrings, but... And I myself have never worn earrings, but I'm sure that even the heaviest of earrings are not more than a couple of hundred grams, because otherwise your head would be weighed down. And we do kind of get to that, get to the verse that I started the show with, and that is, so he makes an ephod, and it says that, so Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more. So maybe they had even heavier earrings, and that was the reason. I don't know. But what do you think the significance was that he created an ephod, a priestly garment thingy, and a ceremonial garment worn by the high priest? What do you think the significance was that he created one of those from the spoils of a victory that God had brought about?
Either he's being very spiritual to remind the people that this isn't his victory, it's God's victory, and he's going to bestow the ephod on some spiritual guy to lead them in repentance and spiritual revolution. Or he thinks, whoa, sweet, I'm a leader now. I should probably get some spiritual action on top of this, because that's what God's all about. So maybe if I make this, I'll get even more power and influence. Or maybe I can build a tower to my own name that people will bow down to, and then I'll have more influence.
Yeah, well, it might have ended up going a little bit more like the latter thing that you said there, because while the ephod was a garment, essentially like a breastplate on the front and the back of the priest's garment that was used to inquire of God, it says that all of Israel hoard after this ephod that was created, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. So it seems as though his intentions may have been good, to create a symbol of God's deliverance, and a symbol that listening to God brings about deliverance and wealth. But what ended up happening eventually was Israel, as was their wont during this time period, they kind of did their own thing, and part of their own thing was being led astray by what started with good intentions. So maybe they worshipped this ephod, or maybe there were some heist attempts or something to get it, because they It became a snare to the whole family and to all of Israel. So pretty intense.
Worst.
So it does say that Gideon went on to live in his own house. We don't know if he lived in his father's house or not while he was threshing wheat in the wine press, but let's assume that he was in his own place nearby his family. That was kind of the custom. And it says that Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he called his name Abimelech. Do you know what Abimelech means?
From looking at the word, it must mean, a leech that has a bimmer.
Close. Well, he does go on to do some parasitic things, I suppose, but his name actually means, my father is king.
Oh, hello.
Yeah. So, even though Israel said to him, you should be our king, and he said, I'm not gonna be, he went on to not only live as a king, having as many children as he would like, with as many women as he wanted, he went so far as to make a public and eternal statement in naming his child after his own achievements. So we see just how far the humble have fallen. He started out as the least of the least and became the most of the most in all of Israel in his own eyes. And so that's kind of what happens to Gideon. And the fact that his reign was kind of ensnared by his own actions is a little bit telling as well. So even though Israel had 40 years of rest in the days of Gideon, those 40 years were slightly corrupted by the fact that they had begun to worship something man-made and make idols and other things like that. And even Gideon began to worship himself or allow himself to be worshipped. So, Gideon, what are you doing, mate?
What are you doing, mate? But, and it's funny because later on God uses a similar humble guy in David. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And David ends up being the closest one to God's heart and a really good king, and he leads Israel into good things. And so you wonder if God constantly was looking for that. Like, I'm going to start with this humble guy from the lowest of the low, and he's going to be my leader that points to me all the time and leads people to goodness. But it just keeps not happening. Which must be so frustrating.
Oh, absolutely. And they say that humble beginnings make the best leaders. I don't know if they say that. I just said that then. So I might be the one that says that. I say that humble beginnings make the best leaders. And that might not be true. But it does seem as though they are the ones that hold on to their humility the longest. Yeah. Okay. Hold on for one more day. Exactly. So maybe if somebody was taken, like Solomon and David, a great contrast, because David goes from nothing to everything, and he still retains the favor of God for the most part, for most of his life. And Solomon has the favor of God, and then he kind of just lets it go away.
Yeah.
Because he grew up with everything, and maybe the proverb that I talked about in the last episode with Gideon only having 300 men, maybe that being written by Solomon was important, because it might not have been from Solomon, but it said, grant me exactly what I need. If I have too much, I might say I can do it without God, or I did this myself.
Yeah.
And if I have too little, I say God doesn't care about me. So maybe that could have been the writer's way of conveying this struggle, this tension that leadership is supposed to live inside of, in acknowledging that God has provided what you have, but also trusting that God will provide what you don't.
Yeah.
And not allowing yourself to really fall off the tightrope either way.
Yeah.
And Gideon did. He fell off the tightrope in the way of feeling like he had everything, And it says, as soon as Gideon died, at a good old age, don't know how old that was, but we can assume maybe 80. 80 is a decent age. As soon as he died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal-berith their god.
Gross.
The people of Israel didn't remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hand of their enemies on every side, just 40 years before. But I suppose that's kind of like the time difference between us and the 70s,
yep.
Which may seem like a just the blink of an eye, but it also might... It's been people's entire lifetimes, and I wasn't alive in the 70s, neither were you, and so... I don't know. The fact that we grew up during peacetime. Sorry?
That's when the best music was.
Yeah, arguably. So, I think the fact that 40 years is kind of a couple of generations removed from the original events has allowed enough time and culture to draw them away from God.
Yeah.
And we have kind of seen that with some of the other judges, but Deborah seemed to be one that was a lot more involved and took her duties seriously, but Gideon kind of got lazy. And even though there was peace, just let Israel do whatever they wanted and wasn't as maybe involved in the spiritual upkeep as he should have been.
Worst.
Okay, so the very last verse of this chapter talks about how the people of Israel didn't show steadfast love to the family of Gideon in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. So Israel has decided that instead of Yahweh, they're going to go for Baal-berith or some other god, local gods of the area probably. And they decide that even though Gideon did stuff for them, they're not going to treat his family with respect anymore. So next episode, we'll get into Abimelech, who is the son of Gideon. His name means, again, my father is king. And how he kind of deals with the legacy of Gideon in a time when Israel is doing whatever they want.
Which they have done many times before, so it's getting boring, Israel. So many times. Do something different.
I know. Well, we do only have a couple of judges left, which is interesting. I think we have Jephthah. He's pretty significant. And then we have Samson, and that's it. So we're getting close to finishing up this time period before Samuel, the last judge, and moving into a different kind of Bible reading format as we jump between books and between stories and between prophets and things. It's going to be... It'll be very exciting. So, Jeremy, do you have any closing thoughts about Gideon and maybe some advice to give the listeners?
Yeah. If someone asks you for bread and they've just rescued you from an oppressor, you may as well just give them some bread and some water and maybe a massage or two. Also, if you are from the lowest of the low, you too can become an arrogant, godlike king. No?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
I'm excited for that. That's what I aspire to be.
I did not aspire to be that, and I'm not sure if I'm the loser of my family yet. The jury is still out.
All right. Well, with that said, my name's Ryan.
And my name is Jeremy.
You can find us on all the social medias. They're linked in the podcast episode description, title. What do you call that?
The show notes?
The show notes. The show notes. Yep, that's all linked in the show notes, as well as our Patreon if you want to get on board and get an extra episode every couple of weeks talking about a different topic. That'd be great. You also don't have to, so don't feel any pressure. We do enjoy having you get in touch with us. If there's anything about Gideon that you didn't know prior to listening to this, then that's probably your own fault, because we're not the brightest bulbs on the what am I trying to say?
The yeah, I'm a dim
bulbs bulb on the Christmas
in the lampshade
fairy light.
What the fairy light
things? I don't know.
The fairy light strings.
Obviously, I kind of hammered home my own point there. But if you do have anything to add about Gideon, anything that you found particularly interesting, let us know. That'd be great. And I'll leave you with a blessing now, and that is, may all of your bread be freshly baked. And if you are gluten-free, may all of your freshly baked gluten-free bread not taste like cardboard or bricks, but may it taste like bread, even though you aren't able to have real bread. And if you're completely carbohydrate free, may all of your vegetables taste like bread as well. Take that.
Take that, bread.